Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast. As truthful as resources permit, my name's Jimmy and I voted Leave in the EU referendum in 2016.
My name is Jazza and I'm so happy to announce that we at the Right Dishonourable are now an official Lady Hale fan podcast. Yes, Jimmy and I are now wearing our adornment brooches. I'm wearing, of course, a beautiful dragonfly, and Jimmy is wearing a depiction of Lady Hale's beautiful coat of arms, which of course states in Latin, women are equal among all. We do stand the head of the Supreme Court from Redcar. She is bae. She is bae.
I think she's a president, actually.
Yes, yeah, she is president, yes. Yeah. She's very... very cool. We like her a lot. Gay Twitter was going crazy over her because she is so fucking fabulous.
Yeah. Who is Lady Hale?
Lady Hale.
Other than being the president of the Supreme Court.
She's the president of the Supreme Court and therefore read out the judgment today that was announced regarding the whether or not the case that was brought against the court was judiciable. Justiciable. And whether or not the government, or specifically Boris Johnson, broke the law by proroguing Parliament for 5 weeks.
Yes.
And they unanimously, all 11 of them, all said he's been a very naughty boy.
I mean, we knew that already, though, didn't we?
We didn't know it was illegal. Now it's like proper job illegal.
I think the term is unlawful, which my lawyer Twitter informs me is slightly different from illegal.
How so?
I don't know.
Well, great, excellent.
my knowledge doesn't extend that far.
We know you didn't come here for in-depth knowledge, let's be fair.
About anything.
Today, after the ruckus that was social media surrounding the politics that happened today, we've cracked out a couple of beers. We have some Camden Brewery Show Off, which is described as a juicy lager. Not sponsored. But not adverse to it.
If they want to get in touch.
Yeah, no, please do. We'd love some more juicy lager. What are we going to talk about this week, Jimmy?
Well, as per usual, we have three topics for you. The first of which will be the prorogation case and the fact, as Jazza says, the government did behave unlawfully.
Oh, they've been very naughty.
In trying to force for a 5-week prorogation. Mm-hmm. Which is a difficult word to say.
Listen to us stumble over really official words about how Parliament works. Justiciable and prorogatable.
It's got a lot of unnecessary letters in both those words. Following on from that, we are going to be discussing the Labour conference,
which I hear is going really well. Ready to form a government of national unity, I hear. Yeah. Everyone's on the same page.
Well, they've come out with quite a few interesting policy proposals.
My God. Go on. Among them.
Among them, abolishing private schools.
Mm. So we both went to private school.
We did.
Yeah.
We are the establishment.
If only we were the establishment, I feel like it would be more fun.
I think I am the establishment, but I'm not getting invited to the parties.
Could you get us invited to the parties? That would be really nice.
I'll look into it.
Yeah, excellent. So we'll talk about that. Also, there's going to be flexible time off for menopausal women. And
4-day working week.
Four-day working week. Yeah, we're going to work towards a 4-day working week.
Elimination of food banks.
Oh, great.
In a couple of years. Mm-hmm. They're not banning food banks, they just want to put benefits in place too. That would be a very Tory policy, wouldn't it? Like, we're going to eliminate the use of food banks by banning them.
Mm-hmm. We're going to make everybody stuff.
And probably most importantly in the news that caught people's attention at the start of the conference, at the start of the weekend, was the attempt to oust Tom Watson that never really transpired in the end.
Tom Watson is the deputy leader of the Labour Party. He won in 2015 at the same time that Jeremy Corbyn first went in. And he is not really a Corbynite.
He's seen as a Blair right now, which is kind of funny because he played quite a key role in ousting Tony Blair.
Yeah, he's a Brownite, isn't he?
Yeah, really. Mm-hmm. But
we forget that he was a prime minister.
Yes, Yeah, everyone does. Finally, Jazzy, you suggested this topic about school strikes around climate change.
Oh, yes, this is my fault. So Greta Thunberg, quite wonderfully and eloquently, as she does, spoke at the United Nations today, which...
This is after her boat crossing.
After her lovely boat crossing, we were all gripped. And it was, you pointed out on Twitter how strange it is that politicians applaud it when she basically tells them off.
Yeah. How dare you?
Yeah, exactly. As part of a series of protests that are going to be happening over the course of this month, I believe, the climate, what's it called? Action Rebellion. Climate Rebellion?
Extinction Rebellion.
Thank you. God, work on that branding.
I think it's a good name, to be honest.
It is. They have a very good logo as well.
There you go. So their branding's actually pretty great.
Yeah, okay, fine. There were a series of school walkouts last week on Friday.
It was on Friday, yeah.
And I just think it's very interesting seeing the people who partook in these,
the young people,
strikes, the youth, yeah,
the young people.
Yes, the future of our dear world, indeed. I don't know. I feel I am very conflicted about this thing. I think there's a lot of performativity in a lot of this stuff.
Jazz is going to be flaunting his high Tory instincts yeah. that are embedded beneath the surface of this podcast.
Technically, still a Tory. My membership still hasn't run out.
I still have your membership card.
Yeah, why haven't they? I've been very public about the fact that I infiltrated the party.
It's almost as if CCHQ don't listen to this podcast.
How dare you? Right, anyway, we're going to listen to some music. Beg you for some money, truly beg, and then we'll get on with the podcast. Does that sound good?
That does sound good.
Great. Unfortunately, we have yet to convince Camden Brewery to sponsor this podcast with more beer. Until that point, we rely on donations from our patrons on our Patreon account. This is where you can support the podcast. And it really does help us because it means that we're able to continue to pay for web hosting fees and the like so that we aren't paying our own money to be able to give you our dulcet tones into your gorgeous little ears.
That doesn't sound like a super convincing argument.
All right, fine. Who do we need to thank, Jimmy?
We'd like to thank our current patrons, Andrew Kilpatrick, David Warner, Emerson Sparks, Gemma Cumming, John O, Matt and Ollie McGregor. Thank you very much for your support.
Thank you. It does mean a lot. We're going to get on with the show now, okay?
Bye.
So, Jimmy, did you watch any of the Supreme Court
I watched the statement, yeah.
No, but last week when they were putting their case.
Now I have this job thing. It really gets
Oh, I also have this job thing and I had it on in the background the whole time. And was there going like, ooh, like in the background with a load of international people who have no interest whatsoever in what the Supreme Court
I sort of followed it vicariously through Twitter, so I only saw the reactions. Uh-huh. Sort of like going to a football game and then just turning and watching the audience rather than play on the pitch.
It was clear to me that the key question here was whether or not the case was even justiciable. And that's basically whether or not the courts can even get involved in the case.
Yeah, it's like, is this a legal matter? Mm-hmm.
So that's basically how they got away with it in the English courts, because it was seen as non-justiciable. And it felt like if the Supreme Court decided that it was justiciable, then Boris Johnson was almost definitely going to get his knuckles wrapped in some way, shape or form. From the presentations of the previous week, I did kind of get the vibe that they were probably, from the lines of questioning that the judges were during the case, I did kind of get the vibe that they were going to probably say that it was justiciable and they were probably going to fall on the side of the government
unlawfully.
Not illegally. Even I was surprised that it came down with a unanimous decision of all 11 judges.
That wasn't what most people were saying ahead of time, because particularly the Gina Miller case, which was whether, the previous Gina Miller case, which was whether the government had a right to trigger Article 50 without consulting Parliament. I think there were three, dissenting judges, and that went to the Supreme Court as well. So I think the assumption was that at least maybe some of those people would actually dissent against a decision that went against the government in this case. But as you say, all 11 justices actually did say, no, we think you've made a mistake here. So people seemed, even like the lawyers I follow on Twitter, who were generally quite sceptical about Brexit, were not expecting that, I don't think.
Yeah. Why do you think that's significant?
Well, it's a united front, so it's not... You know, in the Gina Miller case, at least some of the justices thought that the government had something of a case when they said we could trigger Article 50 if we wanted to. We don't need to consult Parliament. But in this case, nobody thought that the government had a good case. Mm-hmm. In some ways, because it didn't seem as though the government had actually engaged with the case that thoroughly and hadn't provided any reasons why they would have been justified in having a 5-week prorogation.
So I feel like the thing that lost it during the case was the fact that the government had nobody who would sign a declaration of the motives behind the prorogation purely being starting a new parliamentary session, instigating with a Queen's speech. Because nobody was willing to sign that declaration and therefore implicate themselves in a pretty bloody serious legal issue, felt like that lack of evidence in favour of the government was the thing that really kind of cemented it.
Well, if you sign, not just as a minister but as anyone, if you sign a statement and submit it to a court under oath, then if that statement turns out to be false and you've knowingly said something false,
then you go to the Tower.
Well, you've committed perjury, so you've lied, officially lied in front of court, which is bad. It's so very, very naughty.
Does it matter? This seems to be a question that Boris Johnson keeps on being asked whenever he leaves kind of like buildings to get into his car. People seem to be really concerned about the fact that he lied to the Queen. As a Republican, Jimmy, why do you think that matters?
I don't care. I think it's a... I mean, I personally don't care. I think it's a rhetorical device because the Queen is still... The Queen has actually come out of the whole Brexit process fairly well, I think. Despite the fact that she authorised the prorogation, nobody seems to have blamed her for doing so.
No.
Which, from a little... Like, the Queen, in our current constitutional setup, basically just does what the Prime Minister says when it comes down to, the Prime Minister giving her advice. So it wasn't that surprising. But... Do you remember like the amount of like stories there were about, or the amount of calls for like the Queen to intervene on one side or the other of the Brexit debate?
I don't think anybody was really very serious about
it. I disagree. Really. I think there were some crazy Brexiteers who were deadly serious about it.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, if you want to include the crazy Brexiteers, I may as well include all of the crazy Remainers in that as well. Like there were people on both sides who were like, the Queen should like fuck shit up. And it's like, if you've paid any attention over the past like 60 years of her reign, you know, she is just going to go along with it because she doesn't want to be the person that then that's not her role. She doesn't see that as her role.
So I mean it's kind of a good jibe. I think led by Donkeys, which is the kind of campaigning group that does billboards.
They're brilliant. They're really quite good.
They projected something onto Buckingham Palace, I think, which said, Queen, your Prime Minister, your Majesty, your Prime Minister lied to you.
It's nice of them to put it on her house where she's not going to see it if she's in.
True.
Seems a bit silly.
Unless she turns on the TV, I suppose.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
The thing is, we know Boris Johnson's a liar. I'm not... That sounds a bit flippant, but that's the one thing that can be established about... Oh, it's one of... Obviously, there are other things that can be established about it, but do you know what I mean? Political character, his lying is very integral to who he is as a person.
My fate, can I just... maybe we should have a spot on the podcast where we talk about our favourite Boris Johnson lie of the week. My favourite Boris Johnson lie of the week was there's no press here.
And there were.
Yeah, there they were.
They were filming
like
him.
Filming you. So this was the video where people seem to love doorstep it, like citizens. Some of them are like Labour activists or whatever, or some kind of like Remain activists. But he keeps on having really quite awkward interactions with members of the public. And there was somebody in an NHS office, hospital who went up to Boris Johnson and was like, this place doesn't have any... it's really annoying that you're here kind of parading around for the press. Boris Johnson then looks at the press, looks back at the man and goes, there's no press here.
It's so brazen.
And then the man just
the goes, man goes... But then...
But... look! Like... The lamest attempt of gaslighting that I think I've ever seen.
The thing is, he in that situation, Johnson could have just said, okay, yeah, you know, I have come down, this is a press visit, but I'm taking an interest in the state of our hospitals and I'm trying to address what needs to be fixed. And, you know, I'm speaking to people like you. Yeah, there, yeah. He could have easily sort of handled that situation and he chose not
and
to.
He chose to look at what he was going to lie about. Then lie about it.
Someone made the point, and I think this was like a former government advisor, I can't remember who it was, but they said that part of the reason they think that Johnson gets heckled so much more aggressively than other people is because he's a TV personality, and therefore people feel that they have a personal relationship with him in a way that they didn't necessarily with previous prime ministers.
Perhaps. I think also it must have something to do with poor kind of like PR management on his end. Like, in terms of making sure that he's in spaces, you would never see Theresa May go into a space where she would end up encountering that kind of a thing. But also, maybe there's a phenomenon of people being taken aback by actually how, like, her demeanour in person. Whereas Boris Johnson, it feels like, yeah, I'd take a piece out of him.
Well, you do have to hand it to him. He still does, like, he does sort of walkabouts and shakes hands and stuff like that. So he does expose himself to these things, which I think is admirable, whatever else you say about
him. Is it admirable? I feel like it allows his base to double down. He's really far, well, the Conservatives, maybe not him, but he's very hard, far ahead in the polls at the moment. But we know that polls do
fickle things.
So Laura Kornsberg tweeted...
This is the BBC's political editor.
Yes. Sometimes we talk about her. She's reasonably good at her job. She had a number 10 source who said... who said that we think... speaking as the government, we think the Supreme Court is wrong and has made a serious mistake in extending its reach to these political matters. Further, the Supreme Court has made it clear that its reasons are connected to the parliamentary disputes over and the timetable for leaving the European Union. We think this is a further serious mistake. We will study the judgment carefully to consider how we can best respond to these unique circumstances. Should they be saying that the court has made a mistake? And to what end are they saying that the court has made a mistake? What are they expecting to get out of that?
Well, I suppose they're just trying to make it seem as though the decision was contentious.
Despite it being unanimous.
Unanimous, yeah. So they do have a shade of a point in that in Lady Hale's judgment, she did...
We stand. praise be.
She did make reference to... to the timing of the prorogation, which it would have been difficult not to do so, given what the case was about. But she's effectively said that Boris Johnson had deprived Parliament of its ability to scrutinise his decisions at a very sensitive time politically, which was the essence of the case, really. So to that degree, when Number 10 says, you know, this is, you know, her judgment is part, or sorry, the court's judgment is partly based on that fact, that is true, but I don't really see how it could not have been, really. That part is sort of interesting because it maybe suggests that if he decided to prorogue for 5 weeks at a non-politically sensitive time, it, you know, that would have swung the judgment slightly more in his favour, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But they said in the judgment that prorogation usually only requires 4 to 6 days for the government to prepare.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, surely any prorogation longer than that should be illegitimate. For if you want a consistent standard about these things.
Yeah, but we don't have a consistent standard for it, really, because there's nothing written down about how long prorogation can be.
The thing is about the Supreme Court is that it's not...
It's also relatively new.
So Tony Blair put it together. We used to have a House of Lords court, which actually sat properly in Parliament, and one of the things that Blair did was move it out into a building across Parliament Square, I think. I think it's pretty still near the Houses of Parliament.
Okay.
But So it actually was physically separate, and like it was seen to be slightly more modelled on the US Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. The US Supreme Court's main aim in a lot of cases is to protect the US Constitution, but my understanding anyway is that the UK Supreme Court is really there to uphold parliamentary sovereignty and Parliament's interests. Like, that is...
Well, that's what this case has ended up cementing, because there's never really been a clarification of that being its main role. And it is there to uphold the British Constitution, but as we know, the British Constitution exists across many different like conventions and pieces of paper and laws, and like, it's a very complicated thing. What I think the Supreme Court was meant to do was, I mean, because Scotland has a very different legal system to England and Wales.
England and Wales, yeah.
Which was why this ended up going to the Supreme Court.
So you didn't mention it, but there were two cases. There was the English case, which went in the government's favour.
And said that it wasn't justiciable.
And the Scottish case, which not only said it was non-judiciable, but basically accused Boris Johnson of having improper motives for proroguing Parliament.
Yes, exactly. And then the Supreme Court allows for there to be kind of like a nationwide unification of High Court decisions.
I mean, so long as Scotland and England have been in a union, there has always been
Scotland's legal system pre-exists the union as well.
Yes,
so that's why they have civil law, and the rest of us have common.
They have a mixed common civil law system.
Aren't all systems slightly mixed?
Yeah, massively so.
We talked about this before going on air, as if this is being broadcast. You've never listened to Nigel Farage's LDPC show.
I've not.
So you know what? I had a spare hour because you were late, and I decided to have a little listen. First of all, fascinating listening. In that, they just tee up person who agrees with him, person who agrees with him, dissenter, but who is ready to have their mind changed by Nigel Farage, person who agrees with him, person who agrees with him. And it was so interesting hearing them wrap their heads around the fact that they love the Queen, and they love the idea of there being a Supreme Court that has kind of like laws that need to be upheld, and they are laying the blame squarely at Boris Johnson's feet.
Mm.
But more so the fact that, he has the right intentions of trying to kick the can down the road until we officially leave the European Union on the 31st of October. But he's done it the wrong way. He's clearly played his hand poorly, is what they have kind of thought about it. What do you think of that as kind of like a viewpoint from like the Brexity side of things? It was also really interesting seeing all of the Brexit Party MPs being interviewed on BBC News, and not saying that this was not going nearly as far as the source that Laura Koonsberg had from Number 10, but seeing them kind of say it's like this is just another frustration, and not like being specific about where the fault lied. How do you think they are going to be able to get around the fact that this is a legal judgment that they respect but they don't agree with?
Well, I think that, you know, Parliament has been recalled at this point. I mean, officially it was never prorogued in legal terms.
Officially it never happened. I love that as a thing. It's like, it never happened.
Yeah, from a legal point of view, it I guess it didn't happen. But in practical terms, it did
happen. It definitely happened.
It did happen.
Yeah. We remember. I protested it.
So I think at this point they just have to get on with it. But I don't think it really practically means that much at this point, because when Johnson decided to prorogue Parliament, I don't think he expected that Parliament would pass the anti-no deal legislation, i.e. the legislation championed by Hilary Benn to actually force Boris Johnson to apply for an extension to our EU membership, so we don't leave on the 31st of October. I thought that him proroguing Parliament was to block that sort of behaviour, but then Parliament went and did it before they were prorogued anyway. So, and it's not clear at this point whether there is a majority for a vote of no confidence in a general election. So I'm not really sure, even though Parliament has effectively got some time back from the weeks that it otherwise would have been off, I'm not really sure what it's going to do with that time. So from a practical point of view, I don't really know, but you know, Brexiteers, however much it annoys them, and so many Brexiteers that, like, pundits, I think, like, Toby Young, Charlotte Gill of the Daily Mail were just going absolutely mental on Twitter and saying this is, like, an outrage and the Supreme Court is biased in favour of Remainers and just going totally loopy.
Jimmy, yes. As a representative of the 52%.
I'm not sure I am on this particular issue.
Okay, as a representative of your own view as a Brexiter, what do you think of this ruling?
I mean, there have been quite a few testing of the boundaries of parliamentary procedure and various legal conventions and whatnot. You know, I don't think Remainers can honestly say that it's only Leavers that have played this close to the line. But, you know, at the end of the day, Boris Johnson did something that was unlawful. You know, previously, it wasn't obvious that it was unlawful. Mm-hmm.
So actually technically really has nothing to do with Brexit.
Yeah, technically speaking, it's just a question of whether you can prorogue for a long time mm-hmm. for, you know, ulterior motives or seemingly ulterior motives. I mean, the effect of the decision is that if you want to prorogue for a long time, you have to justify it somehow. Mm. Presumably, if Parliament had been largely in favour of it, that it wouldn't really have been a problem. Like, if Parliament, you could even put a motion forward that says this House believes, you know, this House assents to, you know, prorogation for 5 weeks. Presumably, if that was passed, the Supreme Court wouldn't have had any problem with it. But, you know, if, you know, they broke the rules and they have to abide by the rules. So that, you know, that seems like the end of it to me.
Yeah, the interesting part of Lady Hale's, of the judgment that Lady Hale read out was that it was the fact that there was an intent to do a huge, to take Parliament out of the equation in order for a huge constitutional change to the UK to come into effect. And that was one of the main things that kind of like swayed them over the edge.
Yeah.
What do you think Boris Johnson does next? Obviously, everyone now like has said, oh, he needs to resign because they don't like him. There was actually, interestingly, a YouGov poll, super quick poll, but YouGov tend to be a good pollster. They found that there are now it was 43% of people thought that he should resign, 39% thought he shouldn't, with the rest being don't knows. What if you were Boris Johnson, what would you do now?
I don't really know what his options are, because he has
a majority of like minus 30.
So he doesn't have a majority.
A majority of minus 30.
No one seemingly has a majority. He can't call a general election, which is what he tried to do before prorogation took effect. And he said he's drawn his own red line, that he doesn't want to go back and ask for an extension. We have to be out of the EU. And he's still saying, in interviews, he's still saying we are going to leave on October 31st. Mm-hmm. I don't see how that's possible. He has to go back and ask for an extension, like, legally speaking. I don't really see how he can get out of that.
Mm-hmm.
I assume they'll grant it. They have, you know, I think last time we spoke, there were some murmurings from France and that sort of thing that wouldn't take place, but I don't really believe that. I think the thing is, I don't really see what an extension's going to achieve, because
it's a chance to have a referendum.
Well, yeah, other than that.
And I feel like I'm excited because my option is now back in play.
Oh yeah, it is, if Parliament can get a majority for holding a referendum.
So this is where we come to a GNU. No, not the animal. The Government of National Unity.
You're so pleased with yourself.
I'm very pleased with myself. Do you think that, and we'll talk about the Labour Party more specifically in a second, do you think that a Government of National Unity on single issues, like having another referendum to confirm where we go next, do you think that that's possible? To be fair, neither of us are like parliamentary insiders. Thank God, actually.
If they have the numbers, then I think they could do it.
If all of them decide to, then they do.
Although, the weird thing is, you then have a situation where the government... So say, like, Parliament puts forward a bit of legislation to have a second referendum, which I assume is already prepared. I assume that they've already been working on this. And then it passes by a majority in the House of Commons. You then but the government will vote against it, and government affiliated MPs will vote against it. You then have a situation where the government has to set up a referendum that it didn't actually call, which is constitutionally quite interesting, I think, because setting up a referendum is something a government does rather than a legislature, traditionally speaking.
Do you think that a vote of no confidence in Boris Johnson is possible in order for then there to be an interim prime minister, who probably would have to not be Corbyn?
I don't know, because I think that's actually a lot harder. Getting enough people on side to call, like, get a referendum majority in the House of Commons is difficult anyway. And then it's, you know, assuring that enough, you know, enough of those people support a government of national unity for that to take place, that's very difficult, I think.
I don't know. I feel like the last few weeks have really sharpened those minds. And there's been the blip of Labour Party conference. But I think that there is the possibility of there being enough discipline for there to... I don't know. Maybe I'm just kind of like living my ideal timeline right now. But I see a call of a vote of no confidence in the Prime Minister and then an interim Prime Minister that puts together legislation for a second referendum and then a general election.
I think the numbers...
Then actually Boris Johnson might win.
True, yeah, but the numbers are very sketchy at the moment. I really don't... It's very possible the next, like, month and a half could just be a lot of people just sitting on their hands and not doing very much.
Oh, isn't it exciting, though?
The last couple of weeks have been fantastic. From an observer's point of view, it's been kind of amazing.
So talking of a government of national unity and the need for Labour to kind of pull their socks up, had they not decided to kind of like pull themselves apart from the inside, they had a load of really interesting kind of like policy announcements.
Should we talk about the Sir Watson thing first, just to get that out of the
way? So what are they called? The Labour...
NEC? National Executive Committee.
Yes, of Labour, decided to try and abolish the role of deputy leader.
Largely to get rid of Tom Watson, seemingly.
Just to get rid of Tom
And this
Watson.
Was led by John Landsman, who's the founder and leader of Momentum.
So I had a moment last week where, or like on Saturday morning when this story broke, where it was Friday morning, I can't remember what day it was. I, in my head, have always imagined Landsman as kind of like a... like, not a young figure, but somebody in their 30s or 40s, as the founder of Momentum. Jesus fucking Christ, he's old.
He's got a couple
of grandkids.
Incredible beard as
Incredible beard, wispy white hair. He looks like Santa Claus.
He kind of does, yeah.
He is the head of the youth movement, Momentum. Anyway, this failed. Do we know why it failed?
Corbyn sort of balked at the last minute. Although it sounds as though... This is all sort of backroom mutterings, but it sounds as though Corbyn wasn't the pioneer of it initially, and then...
He says that he wasn't aware of it.
When he found out about it, he was not happy with the idea. Mm. I think the implication is that if Corbyn had given it his backing, then Tom Watson would have gone ahead. Because I assume they'd have had to put a motion before a Labour conference to actually get that done. Is that how that works? Or I don't know.
It didn't sound like it. But that would have probably passed if there were like conferences pretty pro Corbyn, doesn't like Tom Watson very much.
I think it was on Friday night there was loads of stuff going around Twitter about all of this happening, and then Saturday morning nothing came of it, and it just made Labour look very, very stupid at a time when the Tories are very much outdoing themselves in looking very, very stupid. It is just another reminder of what a decently led... I'm not even talking about politics now, but just, you know, a well-run or like opposition could actually be doing right now.
I sometimes look into the timeline where anyone else won.
Where Ed Miliband wins the 2015 general election, for instance.
No, I mean, that one is so far gone, I don't even allow myself the humility of looking into that one. But the one where maybe Jeremy Corbyn doesn't get onto the ballot and now we have Andy Burnham as the opposition
leader. Also that, yeah, because he was only like a couple of nominations away from not getting on the ballot.
Yeah, I mean, Jesus. That alternate timeline.
That was a very consequential decision by those people.
By like three people.
Yeah, the handful of people that brought them over the line.
Yeah, I believe all of the people who were kind of like, or just wanted to widen the spectrum of the debate, they've all said, yeah, really wish I hadn't done that.
So that aside, you know, Labour pulling themselves apart. Their policy platform, I actually think some of the ideas are kind of interesting, to be honest. Like,
it's definitely a change, isn't it?
I'm well up for a four-day working week.
Okay, so...
for instance.
I wonder what your motives for that are. So, there was the proposal announced by John McDonnell that they're going to move towards a 32-hour week is the, the proposal the is, over 5 years.
The average that a UK worker works is like 30... Is it? It's less than 40.
Is it less than 40? Okay.
I want to say 35, but it must be higher than that.
I wish I worked less than 40.
but you know, it's sort of like...
But then I get to watch the Supreme Court while I'm in the office. So.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, this is sort of the argument that some people are making on Twitter while they were presumably not doing their jobs. They were like, oh, well, you know, you probably spend 20% of your working week dicking around anyway, so if you just compress all the actual work into 4 days.
There are sociological studies that suggest that if you reduce the amount of work, then your productivity doesn't go down.
Yeah. I mean, for some types of work, that's definitely true, but for other types of work, particularly like, I mean, this is an obvious example, but if you're a shop assistant and someone has to be in the store, you can't, if you like pay someone the same amount and they work 20% less, you're going to have to like pay someone else to do that job. So for them, it's like for some jobs, you know, having an employee work 4 days a week instead of 5 days a week probably doesn't make that much difference.
So 4 day work, we love for purely selfish reasons.
Well, we went from 6 days to 5 days. So
when did that happen?
That's a good question. People used to only get 1 day a week off work. It was kind of a trade union thing that pushed for 5 days.
Oh, so amazing. Well, yeah. I'm down for this. So, here's the one that is closest to home for us poshos.
Okay.
Private schools. Yes. So both of us had shooting ranges at our schools, which is pretty much a defining trait of posh.
The optics are not good.
We don't look great,
as people would say.
Yeah. I feel really icky about abolishing private schools, but I have very few logical reasons for. Well, no, I have a lot of emotions behind it. How do you feel about this proposed seizing of private schools' assets?
So the way it's going to work is that the euphemistic way of describing it is Labour would integrate private schools. Mm-hmm. And that's it. This is one of the things that doesn't really stack up with policy, but by private schools, they're presumably not including like special educational needs and that sort of thing. Or maybe they are. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But they integrate private schools into the public school system, which would include seizing some assets like buildings and facilities and redistributing them to other local schools, I assume. That are in the state system. I don't think they said anything about grammar schools during the whole of this.
I assume that they want to get rid of them anyway, because it's only in Labour, where Labour run councils. It's now a devolved is not the right word, but it's now a council-led decision, so councils can decide whether or not there are grammar schools.
Presumably they can't, though, because all...
No new ones,
is that...
So it was down to the local councils whether or not they were going to close the grammar schools or convert them into...
That was years ago, though, wasn't
it? Yeah. Years and years and years ago. So Essex, for example, where there's a lot of Conservative-led councils, still has a ton of grammar schools.
Yeah, I mean, same with Surrey and Kent, which is... home counties, basically. But, yeah, the...
Essex, I found this out, Essex isn't a home county.
Does it not count?
No, we're not posh enough.
Well, you have a reputation,
to be honest. There's a reason we have the reality TV show.
But personally, I regard private schools as kind of a waste of money, to be honest with you. Even if I had the money myself, I would not send my kid to a private school, because I don't think it's worth. I don't think the money you spend on it is worth the outcome. Because the outcome is sort of assumed to be higher grades and then better prospects of getting to good unis and that sort of thing. There definitely is some research that suggests that if you have a bright kid, it doesn't massively matter which school you send them to. There are people that have.
But if you have a thick kid and you send them to a private school, then they will do better.
Yeah.
I believe it's.
Possibly. Mm-hmm. I don't know. There's some dispute as to what effect it has, but I guess I'm assuming that I'd have bright children, which might not pan out.
Now, the arrogance of the straight man and his sperm.
Yeah. intelligence is significantly genetics anyway. And I think intelligence is a lot of what you get when you push somebody through a school system, how well they do. A lot of it is actually just inherited traits, basically. Schools do have an impact, but I'm a little bit dubious as to whether it's worth paying for a private school. But that's by the by. And also, it does seem crushingly unfair that you have... parents paying for it, assuming it works. So assuming that I'm wrong and it doesn't actually work that well. And it is true that private school kids do occupy a disproportionate amount of good university places and then good jobs as well. Mm-hmm. That definitely is a thing. It does seem unfair, straightforwardly. Mm-hmm. So it does seem like a good idea to abolish private schools for that reason. But legally and practically, you can't stop parents paying for extra tuition, for pushing their kids for extracurricular activities. I think this is actually just going to decentralize the problem to some degree.
That's kind of one of the... So this is one of the things. Private schools most often are really, really good at making sure that kids get good grades, have good educations, do better off later in life. Some of them not, but most of them do. Otherwise, people wouldn't pay money to send their kids there. I think it's really difficult to tell parents that you're not allowed to use the resources that you have built up in order to make sure your kid gets the best education. I think that that's quite a difficult thing to sell to people. And I think that we have a resource with private schools that does work really well. The thing with a lot of private schools, they are classed as charities, and so don't pay certain amounts of taxes, despite the fact that a lot of them have huge dowries and huge amounts of assets that they have. In order for them to maintain that... So here's how I would do it. In order for them to maintain that charity status, I would make sure that they have significant outreach to for pupils who are from less advantaged backgrounds who wouldn't otherwise be able to go. And I mean having 50% of the student body coming from less advantaged backgrounds who'd pay reduced fees or not as many fees.
Presumably you'd have to up the fees of the paying, of the full paying students.
Sure, and maybe you mean test it. But I think that, and maybe this is what Labour means when they talk about kind of like seizing the assets and then redistributing them.
I think they're going for full abolition.
So...
Now that's, well, the motion put before the conference, which was voted through, was for something of that ilk. Whether in practice Labour would renege on that and do something a bit more half-hearted, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I think it, you know, even if a Labour government came into power, it would take a lot longer than a single term for them to pull this off, I think. The amount of legal challenges and, backlash and whatever. And you're fucking with some of the most powerful people in the country when you abolish private schools. So good luck with that. but it probably should be done. I think the system is basically unjustifiable. So...
Yeah, and there are so many cases of when you actually put all of these kids from different backgrounds into the same schools, actually everybody does better rather than...
I thought I'm assuming neither of us have like read reams of research on this, but I thought the research was that if you put like a disadvantaged kids into a good class, they tend to be raised up, but if you put a privileged kid into a bad class, it doesn't tend to hurt them as much as you'd expect.
That's basically what I mean, which wasn't what I said.
Yeah. Yeah. Are there any other Labour policies that came forward that caught attention?
I have never heard... It was Dawn Butler, MP. On the first day of conference, she came out, had to talk about the John Watson stuff, but really wanted to talk about menopausal women getting time off.
So what is this policy that was put forward?
So it was the idea that menopausal women should have flexible... should have more flexible hours, and that should be legally required for any employee who employs over 250 people because of the stress that the menopause can put the body through. Mm. I've never thought about the stresses of going through the menopause and having to work at the same time, despite the fact that many of the women in my life have clearly gone through that. And when you think about it, it just makes sense. Because it's a very... I knew nothing about them, next to nothing about the menopause. Gay man, not affected by it. But seeing kind of like examples of people, of what people have gone through when they've gone through the menopause, and how it can affect kind of like your ability to work properly, it just seems like a policy that it was sensible and made sense. And an area of policy that you don't really hear talked about. You don't talk about kind of like older or middle-aged women policies.
Well, you can make the same argument about women who have, you know, very severe periods, for instance, or...
I think you can make the case for women with really severe periods.
Or if you're broadening it out, you can make the same argument for anyone who has a significant physical... I don't want to describe periods as an ailment, but, you know, any physical condition mm-hmm. that debilitates them and, you know...
Mm-hmm.
You could say flexible working is good, basically.
So we want flexible working, work less anyway, we're going to redistribute the assets of private schools. Fine, okay.
I mean, I'm basically, from a theoretical point of view, fully on board with the Aaron Bastani fully automated luxury communism idea as soon as it becomes practical. Mm-hmm.
Automated luxury space communism is the new adjective.
Is it space communism?
Yeah, that's what Tom Harwood says. Oh, we dropped the Tom Harwood.
Oh, dear. So, yeah, one of the problems for the... Like, I do agree with the gist of some of these policies, but... I do not have incredible faith that Jeremy Corbyn and his team are the ones that I would like to be implementing them. Personally.
Sure. I mean, regardless as to what a future general election turns out, I think that these policies are here to stay regardless as to who is leading the party.
Hmm.
And I think whenever Labour come into power, I think that these are policies that are going to be at the front and centre of their manifesto. And they're bloody popular. And so I think that is interesting anyway. This seismic shift, this shift from kind of like centrism and the third way to a left-wing Labour Party again is here to stay regardless of whether or not Jeremy Corbyn is.
I mean, is it not possible, though, that... there's various theories about the way where politics could go now, but is it not possible that you could have Labour relegated to the sidelines for years and then you have a centrist coming in, a la Blair, and he or she has to then make the party sensible again?
It's the Labour Party. They won't have a female leader, let's be fair.
Or you have the alternative whereby the Lib Dems, who are not polling badly at the moment, actually could... This is a little bit crazy, but they could supplant Labour as mm-hmm. like the main left-wing or leftish party.
They are polling around the same in terms of percentage or above them, actually, at the moment, post-conference.
That's not entirely crazy, but... Mm-hmm.
Also, what I think is also possible, even likely, is that Labour would, when they next come into power, will be restrained by a coalition.
There is also that.
Either with the SNP or with somebody like the Lib Dems, or the likelihood of them going in with the Lib Dems is incredibly low.
But there is the argument that if you think you're going to enter a coalition, you might as well come up with some outlandish policies so that you can concede ground. I mean, you made exactly the same
argument. See Joe Swinson.
Joe Swinson and revoke. It will be interesting. But yeah, you know, I like some of these mm-hmm. policies, even if the private school one makes you feel uncomfortable.
Yeah, it does. It feels like my privilege is being taken away.
Hmm.
I don't know. I see private school as something that really benefited me, actually. And I see the benefit that it can do for people. And I think that when you have that resource of, frankly, a shit ton of money, I think that should be, in the same way that grammar schools can be a really great way of lifting people up. I don't know. I think I'm a Tory when it comes to education. Sorry. I'm like, no, I'm okay with like people being put in sets and all that kind of stuff. But
it does feel as though a lot of people form their opinions on what schooling works based on their own schooling, basically. And they don't really resolve from that very much, even in the face of evidence. But people would say, you do make a good point about like all the resources a private school has, but couldn't you just abolish them, raise taxes a little bit, and then redistribute all of that across all the schools?
There aren't enough shooting ranges to give to all of the schools, Jimmy.
Maybe you could consolidate and have like a shooting range equidistant from a bunch of schools.
Oh, I do like that, actually. Yeah, that's a good plan.
So, it's very important for the coming civil war that every person is trained in the martial arts, as it were.
Jesus Christ,
there's no neat way to segue into... actually, I could segue into this.
Apocalypse.
One potential cause of civil war would be the climate apocalypse, which Greta Thunberg has...
Greta Thunberg?
I can't really pronounce her surname properly.
Thunberg is how you pronounce it in English, I think.
She spoke at the UN
building. I loved your analysis of it. Can you tell me what you saw and how you felt?
I think that... I said this on Twitter, and I think you quoted it earlier, is that there's something just deeply odd about people who will invite a 60-year-old girl who describes herself as a child. I guess is really a teenager, but...
She's a child. She's a child. She's under 18. She's not a... She's not an adult.
She's a teenager. We have a word for that. That, you know, that describes that period of life.
Which is a child.
Is it, though? You can legally have sex in the UK when you're 16 years old. And you can join the army, as people never tire of saying. it's a midpoint, right? She's not a proper child. She's, you know...
she's a fake child.
She's a teenager.
Greta Thunberg, fake child.
Yeah, you have child, teenager, adult. Mm. You know, it's a simple system. But, you know, however you classify her, she's come to the UN to berate, like, these adults that have invited her there. As she's done everywhere she's gone, so fair play for consistency.
She's a great public crier.
And people applaud, like, the people being heckled applaud her. And it's just weird. I mean, the religious comparisons make themselves, frankly. This idea of being chastised by a sort of secular priest. It's just odd. Do you not think it's odd? It's just... Why do you need to invite her to heckle you if you agree with what she's saying already? Just do it. Just
like
do what
Nike.
She says.
I don't know. There is something like actually the climate movement. This is not the first young girl that they have used, and not the first young girl to talk about climate change who has addressed the UN.
Who were the previous ones?
I can't remember her name, but there was a very famous American in like the 70s about anti-nuclear armament, and it was more about nuclear armament than was about climate change, but in a similar way, kind of like chastise you for selling out our future, critiques of capitalism and all of that kind of stuff.
Well, the thing that made me laugh about Thunberg's speech is that she said, if you let us down, we will never forgive you. And I'm like, well, if we let you down, you're going to be dead. I mean, your lack of forgiveness is not much of a threat in the scheme of things.
I have great admiration for Extinction Rebellion.
Really?
People care a lot, and I really appreciate that. I think that they are really bad at winning people over to the argument. Well, they are good is making people think about it and actually making me realise more stuff that I should be doing. Like, I can sometimes be very complacent. It affects me personally. And I think Greta Thunberg is very good at engaging with those decision makers and making them feel really bloody bad and making it feel like they can't do very much, despite the fact that Donald Trump did make fun of her on Twitter while she was doing her speech.
He makes fun of everyone. I wouldn't take that too personally.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
Did you see that amazing camera shot that somebody pulled off? They were focusing on her and she's looking quite neutral, and then suddenly she sort of scrunches up her face and the camera pulls back and Donald Trump is walking across the shot. It's kind of amazing, actually. It's very cinematic.
That's beautiful. I like that.
It is very cinematic.
With Extinction Rebellion, the main, which she's not, she's associated with, but she's not.
She's not like a
proper figurehead of Extinction Rebellion. But one of the main criticisms of their ideas is that, as you say, they do a bad job often of engaging with people who disagree with them, and there is something authoritarian about what they propose. That they are not great respecters of democracy and process, and given the severity of their warnings, I guess you can understand why that would be. But
I also, and this is gonna be very contentious. The idea of the planet is dying is just an incorrect idea, because the planet is going to be fine.
Yeah,
it is.
It's ecosystems.
It's ecosystems that are going to be fucked. Yeah. The planet is fine. The planet will survive us, and the planet is going to go on to do wonderful things after the human race is extinct. And I think that the way that they put those arguments in such extreme terms, and I understand why, because it's kind of like a counter to the other extremist side of things, but I just do not think it is helpful to state stuff that is inaccurate.
Mm. Is there anything in particular that has been flagged as inaccurate?
Like the phrasing of the planet is dying is the one that kind of really irks me.
Mm.
Because that just completely takes away the complexity of the ecological problems that we are facing. Mm. And I think that actually, and maybe this is me getting up on my high horse and thinking that I can do the whole thing better than them. Imagine. But I think that there are better, more plausible arguments that you can make to these people who are in power and who are established in kind of like the power structure around the world, that would be better to make rather than the planet is dying, please save it. I think actually the chances of us being able to reduce carbon emissions and carbon capture and leave oil and greenhouse gases in the ground, or stuff that is going to produce greenhouse gases in the ground, is so incredibly low that we actually need to start focusing on mitigation rather than prevention now. I think that that time is past. So we need to be preparing for mass migrations of people to non-affected parts of the world. We need to be planning for not being able to feed our populations. We need to be planning for new food sources. I think it's too far fucking gone, frankly. And I don't think that's going to be really wonderful for the democratic process either. All of those are going to require really kind of like authoritarian decisions to be made. But you know what? We make these decisions and we fuck the place up. So maybe I actually do agree with them, but I think that the childish and maybe childlike arguments that they make don't help the severity of the cause. I think it is too easy to write them off.
What do you make of the phenomenon of various British schools have actually sort of authorised their kids
to go
off
on strike on Fridays, for example. I mean, or that one, at least that one Friday when everybody don't on call.
They're not on strike, are they? They're just during
school. If
you're at school, you are not a productive member of society. You are taking from society. So if you stop taking for one day, no one cares. it's not like the workers are on strike.
Yeah, right. And I understand the background of it is how Greta Thunberg started doing her thing.
Mm.
I was struck, and I don't know how I feel about this, but this is the phenomenon that I experienced when the strike happened, where I live in Newham, which is the poorest borough in the whole of the United Kingdom, also the most ethnically diverse borough in the whole of the United Kingdom. I have a school, an academy, just outside of my house. Not a single protester Friday morning.
You think this is mainly a middle class driven movement?
And then later in the evening, I pop into Waitrose to grab a sandwich because I'm hungry. There were a load of kids with Extinction Rebellion things picking up beers for their dad as they went off to the rebellion. And I'm like, the kids who are able, maybe it's those kids using their privilege, right? Maybe there's actually something justiciable. No, that's not the right word.
Justifiable.
Maybe there's something justifiable about them being able to use their privilege, and actually that day out of school doesn't affect the middle class kids who shop at Waitrose and carry their dad's Fosters for them, and the kids who really need their education still go into school. But I don't know, it sat really awkwardly with me, because unless you bring along the people, frankly, who get most affected by it are those who are less economically mobile and less economically able, along with the whole climate movement, I mean, then we're buggered. Or they're buggered at the very least. And it just sat with me really awkwardly.
There seems to be a general line of opinion that delegitimizes any kind of protest movement that is seen as too middle class. So, you know, the prorogation protest that you attended.
All of the protests that I attended in the past like 5 years.
Well, a lot of the pro-EU protests have been derided as like too middle class. There was a, you know, a picture from the prorogation protest of like a couple of them on a picnic blanket, sipping out of like flutes or whatever they're called. I mean, you know, middle class people have problems too. Posh people have problems too. They have, you know, they have just as much right.
Put that on a shirt and sell it. Posh people have problems too.
Just as much right to protest things. And to
Can
complain,
that be our next mug? I'm deadly
things.
Serious.
You know, a significant, what is it, like 40% of this country self-defined as middle class? That's a, that's a fair chunk. You know, surely they should be represented. And a lot of people shop at Waitrose, so Waitrose shoppers deserve
it's
representation
actually,
too.
Waitrose is cheaper than my Sainsbury's here, so that's why I shop there. But also they have nicer ready meals.
But they do sell Fosters.
Sell Fosters, so common as muck there. Yeah. It was just, it's part of the phenomenon that makes me feel a bit, it just makes me feel uneasy, because it feels like those people are being left out of something that disproportionately affects them more. If food prices go up, it's poor people that are going to be affected by it.
Yeah, no, that's true. But, I mean, it is a fact of democracies that richer people have more resources to spend on political participation, unfortunately.
Sure. What a great... The two private school boys.
That's just true. Yeah, I don't see any way around that.
Right, on that note, shall we end?
Yes. Where can they find you on Twitter?
At Jazza John on all social media. Please feel free to berate me, whatever, do what you want.
You can find me at JDE Nichols, and you can find the podcast...
Podcast.
I don't know where that was going. You can find the podcast at Right Dishonour or at rightdishonourable.com as well.
Thanks very much for listening. Bye.
Bye.